Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For more than a year, NPR correspondent Daniel Zwerdling has been going deep on how the U.S. military cares for its troops when they return home from Iraq and Afghanistan in trouble. His findings have been troubling. War veterans demoted and discarded for their emotional scars of war. The country and Defense Department resisting and struggling with the true human cost of the conflicts. Zwerdling has traveled the country to army bases and broken homes, telling a story that's hard to tell and hard to hear. This hour On Point on this Veterans Day weekend, a conversation with NPR's Daniel Zwerdling about the challenge of healing troubled troops. Joining me today from Washington is NPR correspondent Daniel Zwerdling. For the last year, he's been investigating the Army's treatment of troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan with mental health issues. His reports of officers punishing returning soldiers with mental health problems prompted multiple government investigations. It's been quite a series. Daniel Zwerdling, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, thanks so much. And thanks for devoting this entire show to talking about troops.
Well, if not today, when? I mean, we can hardly do enough, given the small percentage of the population that's carried the fighting burden of the war. What initially got you onto this, Dan?
I was interested in finding out exactly what the cost has been of the war in terms of health. And I had done a couple of stories looking at the Pentagon's official figures, showing how many soldiers have been killed and how many have been injured. And I felt that those figures fudged the truth a little bit. And one big way that they have fudged the truth is that the Pentagon's figures of wounded in action do not include all the people who've come home with serious mental health problems. And, you know, as everybody listening to this knows, troops who come back with serious post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury or serious depression, I mean, these are people who are injured just as badly as people who've lost a limb. But they have not been counted in the official tally.
You begin to pull on that thread and quite a story unraveled. You know, where did you first begin sort of scratching at this? I mean, you could say on the one hand it ought to be very obvious, but it hadn't quite been until you and a few others, but you in a very big way began digging in. Where did you dig?
I sort of stumbled on a group of soldiers at one Army base, Fort Carson in Colorado. I started calling veterans groups around the country saying, do you know of any, you know, troops who are having trouble getting help when they come back from the war in Afghanistan and Iraq? And the first person who answered the phone was a fellow named Steve Robinson, and in Washington, D.C. And he said, you know, it's interesting that you call me because I just had a conversation with a fellow in Colorado who says that he has met several soldiers at an Army base who have complained that they're having trouble getting care, and would you like to talk to them? And I basically was on a plane, if not the next day, about the day after that. And I first talked to one soldier, and then a second soldier, and then a third soldier. And then I would say, you know, do you have any buddies who are having similar problems? And the ripples just kept getting wider and wider. And the more I talked to these soldiers, and they were all around the country, and most of them did not know each other, I was stunned at how I kept hearing the same stories over and over and over again, horrendous stories of young men, I'm talking about, you know, 19, 20, 21, whatever, coming back, their lives falling apart, their marriages falling apart. They have no idea how to, you know, where to turn for help. When they did try to go get help at the mental health center at the Army base, you know, saying, I'm desperate, I feel like killing myself, they were told, well, come back in a few weeks, come back in a month, and we can squeeze you in for an appointment then. I mean, the story just kept getting so horrendous, I was shocked is the only word, because I kept saying to myself, how could the military, how could the administration, how could top officials not have realized that when you're fighting a terrible, basically hand-to-hand combat war in an urban setting, how could they not have envisioned that they would have huge numbers of troops coming back desperately needing mental health care?
Now,
the care wasn't there.
When you began to look at these troops, they were veterans of these wars, certainly. They had been there and fought. They weren't veterans, most of them, in the sense that they were finished with the military, out, on into civilian life. They were still wrestling within the context of military service, which was hard for them and hard for their superiors.
That's right, Tom. And I think a lot of people listening to these stories, they're, you know, the general population gets a little blurry about the difference. But there's a big difference. There's active duty troops who, as you say, are still in the military. They're still serving. And then there's veterans who are the ones who came back, are no longer in the military, and that's a whole different medical system. So these were troops who, and there are still huge numbers of them out there. These are troops who have come back. They're still supposed to be showing up every day at formation, crisply dressed, you know, perfect haircuts, training with weapons, and they are, many of them, seriously mentally ill. Anyway, shocked is the only word. You know, one thing that keeps shocking me is that I've talked to top officials, including an assistant secretary of defense who was sitting in the Pentagon, a general, other top officials in the military who have kept saying to me, "Well, you have to understand, we did not anticipate the high rate of mental health problems of troops coming back from the war." And I felt like shaking some of them and saying, "Hello, have you done any reading in your career?" I mean, after the Vietnam War, and I'm sorry to sound a little flip here, because this is a very, very serious and tragic topic. After the Vietnam War, the Army itself sponsored some of the best research ever done anywhere in the world on the effects of combat on mental health. And they, for many, many, many years, followed Vietnam vets and analyzed every aspect of their lives and mental health. And the Army's own studies showed many years ago that there was a, you know, perhaps 30% of troops who had fought in Vietnam came back with serious mental health problems that affected their everyday lives. And that's the important thing we're talking about here. These are troops who come back and they become, many of them become alcoholics. They abuse drugs. They can't hold down a job. They get violent against their spouses and their families. These are people who are going to cause huge problems in towns across America now, the people coming back from these wars.
But in fairness, the military perhaps should have been anticipating more, but it wasn't anticipating Vietnam Redux. It was anticipating something more like the Gulf War, pretty quick in, pretty quick out. Ramifications afterward, yes, but not within the ranks of soldiers who they would feel they would need to send back to service and could not count on.
And Tom, you raise a fair point, but that was only a fair point for the first whatever months of 2003. The military did think this was going to be swift and, you know, quote unquote, painless. The shock and awe was going to batter the Iraqis into quick submission. But by the fall of 2003, let's remember, it was already clear that the insurgency was going to be a very tough enemy. You know, this was not going to be a quick and easy war. I mean, everybody started raising their eyebrows at that famous moment when President Bush was on the, you know, ship on the aircraft carrier with that banner. What did the banner say?
Mission accomplished.
And by the fall of 2003, it was already clear that that was not true. The mission was a long way from being accomplished. And so from the fall of 2003 on, everybody in the health system of the military, I think, should have been saying, uh-oh, we've got to completely refigure what we were thinking, and we've got to remember all that we learned from the Vietnam studies, and we've got to look at the mental health system and see, do we have enough resources in place? And anybody could have told them at the Army bases and the Marine bases, no, you do not have the mental health staff in place. In fact, you know, in recent years, mental health slots in the military have been cut back. People have been quitting. They have not been able to attract enough qualified mental health people to fill the slots they had. I mean, there was already a crisis developing in mental health, but, you know, where were people in the military who were spotting this? I still don't get it.
Daniel Zwirling, you brought back the testimony, the tape, to make this vivid to all of us. Here's a bit of it. We're going to listen in this hour to just as much as we can. This was Army Specialist Billy Talley. He returned home for 2 weeks' leave from Afghanistan last Christmas. When he got to the airport to go back to Afghanistan, this soldier started shaking. He recalled the experience here, along with his wife, Natasha Talley, in conversation with you.
I don't know. I, like, just had no control over myself, no control over my mind, my body.
You had been wandering the airport.
For a couple hours, yes.
For a couple hours before you'd even called me. I didn't know what he was going to do. He just sounded very disoriented. He was not himself.
At the end of that same year, last year, Tyler Jennings, a soldier at Fort Carson in Colorado Springs, told my guest, Daniel Zwirling, that when he returned from Iraq, he felt so depressed that he wanted to kill himself.
And, you know, there are many times that, you know, I've even told my wife that I really wish I just died over there, Because if you just die over there, everyone writes you off as a hero.
Just two of the active duty soldiers you spoke with, Dennis Woodling. You can hear them and their families struggling with the burden on their shoulder.
Oh, yes. That last person, Tyler Jennings, actually, he came close to committing suicide one night. This is a fellow who, when he tried to get help, it was clear he was falling apart to everybody. He had his supervisors had hailed him as a stellar soldier in Iraq. They told me he had been awesome. He had never gotten into any trouble in the military. Everybody looked up to him. He was getting promoted. Shortly after he came home to Fort Carson in Colorado, he started, he would wake up in the middle of the night, having flashbacks, choking his wife. He was depressed. He knew he was falling apart. And one night, he went up to the second floor of their bungalow, and he opened the window. There's a little balcony there, which he showed me, and a little railing, and he got one of those long electric extension cords, orange cord, and he wrapped it around his neck and, made a military-style knot, and he sat there drinking vodka, a whole bottle of vodka, trying to get up the courage to jump and hang himself. And I've talked to so many troops that this happened to, and they say the worst part wasn't what happened to them in Iraq. It's how their officers and buddies mistreated them when they came back and said to them, "You are a weakling, get out of my face."
We're talking this hour about Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans and the hard side of coming home with NPR correspondent Daniel Zwerdling, who spent much of the last year investigating soldiers' struggles and the U.S. military's struggle to accept and deal with those wounded soldiers. Denny Zwerdling has spent a lot of time all over the country talking with vets, officers. It has been hard for them to figure out how to deal with this. He mentioned just before the break soldiers who would come home violent. He spoke with three that we'll hear from right here, all of whom said they were glad to serve in Iraq. But on their return, they each said they were getting violent in their sleep, threatening their wives. Here are the voices of William Morris, Tyler Jennings, and Alex Orham.
And I woke up, and I was grabbing her neck, and I just started to cry. And then she started to cry, and she's like, Billy, you need to go get help. This is not you.
There had been a couple of times where I'd kind of like rolled over and put my hands around her throat and started to squeeze, and then she woke me up.
My wife would start, slapping my face or whatever, waking me up in the middle of the night. Because I'm over there, screaming and rolling around with my hands around her neck.
There's intimate testimony. The last was Alex Orham. Here's his wife, Donna Orham, talking to Daniel Zwerdling, said he started to knock her to the ground when he returned from Iraq.
He was the most loving, caring guy that you can know. And now, sort of this little thing I say to him or look at him wrong, he wants to hit me. I lost my husband. I lost the man that I fell in love with.
Tape from Daniel Zwerdling's year and more of reporting on returned Iraq war veterans. Now, Daniel Zwerdling, I want to ask you first, because part of what we know comes home from war is emotional distress, potentially psychological distress, but also, there can be stereotypes that come home from war. We want to be careful not to just lay the notion of being emotionally unhinged on everybody who comes home from war. Did you ever fear in the course of your reporting this that while you were drawing attention to those who do have troubles, you may have been, in some ways boxing everybody in to a stereotype that might not fit?
The stereotype being the movies about Vietnam veterans who have red bandanas and live in the forest and hunt wild boar with their bare hands.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't worried about that, and I certainly hope nobody's gotten that impression. And one thing that military people keep saying over and over again when I interview them, officers especially, they keep saying, look, you have to remember that they say most people who come back from the war do not have mental health problems. I have talked with a lot of mental health specialists who have serious problems with that statement. Nobody is suggesting that everybody who comes back has the sort of crises that these young men and some young women I've talked to have had. Mm-hmm. But the statistics that the military puts out are very murky and tricky and questionable. Mm-hmm. Let me just mention a few statistics.
Please.
The military will tell you, and they just put out a report recently, saying about 15% of the people who've come back from the wars have sought mental health treatment. 15%. But if they're suggesting with that that 85% of the people who've come back are not having any serious problems, mental health specialists have a big problem with that because, first of all, we don't know for sure what they mean by seeking mental health treatment. A lot of veterans who are no longer in the military who have serious mental health problems have not sought mental health treatment. In fact, I was just talking to some Marines this past week and just came back from Tennessee, people who told me that at their when they were in some of their worst crises, drinking themselves into oblivion basically every night of the week, taking all kinds of drugs to try to dull their mental pain, they thought they were fine. You know, they thought they were doing just great. They were so out of it. They were so much in another psychological orbit that they actually didn't realize how sick they were. Second of all, a lot of people who do realize that they're sick do not seek mental health treatment because they're afraid to admit it to themselves and to their friends and family that they're falling apart. And some people don't even and if they're in the military, there's not just a fear that if I admit I have emotional problems that people are going to think badly of me. It's been proven. In fact, one of the main points of my stories was that I showed how everybody from sergeants on up to top officers at military bases actively looked down on, actively had contempt for, and actively punished many of the troops who came home and had mental health problems because they feel that if you have a mental health problem from war, you're a sissy. I mean, they use other words commonly that I can't use on the air. Mm-hmm. And they punish them. I've talked with several guys, including a Marine this week in Tennessee, who when their officers found out that they were having serious mental health problems, they would make them sit for hours at a time, 6 to 8 hours at a time, on a chair outside the commander's office, right in headquarters where everybody would pass them. Mm. It's sort of like the dunce's corner. Mm-hmm. So everybody could pass by and say, see, Tom, look, there's Tom. Mm-hmm. Tom is a weakling. He's a blankety blank, blank, blank. Mm-hmm. Look at him sitting there like a little sissy instead of out training with us. I mean, that just think what that does to somebody who has good mental health. What do you think it does to somebody who's already feeling suicidal?
I mean, that's laid on officers in your reporting, but it also comes back to the whole country because it kind of forces us to look at the really true full cost of war. After all, we asked the military to put these soldiers, to put enough soldiers back in the field to go right on with the undertaking here, and you can feel the pressure they're under to do that. Let's listen here for just a minute, Danny, to some of your tape. Again, this is Sergeant Travis Platt, based at Fort Carson, Colorado Springs, admitting that he has asked soldiers to cancel alcohol and drug abuse counseling when it interfered with training.
We have a training schedule. We have things that the Army needs to get done. That's what you need to be focused on. You can't train for a day, go to an appointment, come back, train for a day, go to another appointment. You just don't get any training value out of it.
They've got to train to go back to war. Here's Sergeant Drew Preston, who's also based at Fort Carson, Colorado, saying that he thinks most of the soldiers who claim to have PTSD, post-traumatic stress, wait a minute, PTSD, are faking it.
The order comes down that, you know, we're going back, and then all of a sudden, oh, I got PTSD.
I think guys are just getting scared, and they're like, yeah, I don't want to go back and get into all that, you know? So, yeah, I got PTSD, so whatever. But, I mean, it's a war. You know, it's a war. It's not a happy day in La-La Land. People are faced with fear, so they tuck their tail and run.
Post-traumatic stress disorder as
right.
Tucking tail and running. The Army has things it needs to get done. How do you look at that side of the equation, Daniel?
My heart goes out to these young men because they've been given an impossible task, really, which is to train people to go back to the war in Iraq or Afghanistan and face huge odds in a very difficult situation. And so these guys are desperate to get their unit in order, to get, you know, all the slots filled for this kind of machine gunner, this kind of equipment specialist, this kind of, you know, I mean, they have specific slots. It's like a factory, you know, everybody has
sure.
a job. And they've got to go back and face this terrible, you know, combat in a very difficult urban environment. And they've got to have everybody trained and watching each other's back. So when they go back, you know, let's pray that everybody comes back safely. So if you put yourself in their head, you can understand why they just don't have the energy, they don't have the time, they don't have the money. I mean, look at how many troops were sent into combat without the proper armor, right? Mm-hmm. They don't have the resources to deal with the soldiers who come back with severe, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder or depression or whatever. I mean, several military people who are very sympathetic to this issue we're talking about said to me, you have to understand something, and that is that these soldiers and Marines who get an emotional trouble like this, they are a big pain in the butt. I mean,
for the operation of the force. I mean, they're hard to deal with.
Terribly hard to deal with. They're undependable. They're irritable. Yeah. They fly off the handle in a second. They don't show up for formation. I mean, and so the people preparing to go back to the war, just they want to wash their hands of these guys and get rid of them. Now, their feeling is, hey, it's the medical division's problem. Mm-hmm. Why don't they take care of these guys? Okay, so let's say that all the officers sent all the people with mental health problems to the medical center. Well, the medical center should be taking care of them, but then there's a new problem. And that is that, as we were talking about before, there's a huge shortage of mental health staff at military bases around the world. And so here you are, you're falling apart. You need help now. I need help this second. And somebody says to you, come back in 3 weeks. Or in a couple cases, I've talked to troops recently, Marines, who they were told, come back in 3 months for a mental health appointment. And that's for one appointment. Okay, so you talk for 50 minutes. Big deal. And then you say, okay, when can I come back? My marriage is falling apart. They say, well, we have an appointment for you in another 3 weeks.
And this could have been the guy with the orange cord around his neck on the windowsill.
And it was.
So how did the military deal with it, you found? I mean, they were taking steps to demote, to discard these soldiers.
Exactly. And what happens is military people said to me, look, we've never gotten rid of somebody because he had mental health problems. No. Well, with some exceptions. What they say is, we got rid of Tom because he was a screw-up. Mm-hmm. Tom, you know, didn't come to formations on time. And Tom talked back to his NCOs, his non-commissioned officers, his sergeants. And Tom, you know, was a flake at training the other day. Well, all of those are true. And if you ask any mental health specialist, they'll tell you that people with serious mental health problems, you know, don't necessarily show up on time. They don't take orders well. You know, I mean, you know, I don't have to go into this. Right, everybody understands that. Right. And so they get rid of them for patterns of misconduct, or they get rid of them because they were caught smoking marijuana.
When you say get rid of them, you mean actually often right out of the service, and then do they still have access to care at all? Or?
Well, that's one of the hugest problems. What they do is they give them there are different kinds of discharges, mm-hmm. and if you don't get an honorable discharge, if you get anything less than that, depending on the degree of how much less, you lose all kinds of benefits. So I talked with a former Marine about a month ago in California and visited him for the day, and he had come back with horrendous injuries, physical spinal injuries. He went into horrendous depression. He was diagnosed with PTSD. He couldn't get any help at the mental health center. Mm. He started drinking and smoking marijuana every day, and when they caught him, they gave him they were going to court-martial him, but his lawyer negotiated a general discharge under honorable conditions. That means he gets his VA medical benefits.
Right.
He can get free medical care. But he can't get his GI Bill rights, and that means he doesn't have any money to go to college. One of the main reasons why many of the soldiers and Marines I've interviewed signed up in the first place for the military is because you get the government to pay for your college education once you get out of the service. And Congress created that many years ago as an enticement for people to sign up for the military. Now, I just talked to a Marine. I visited him in the Nashville area this past week. He had a similar story. He was kicked out with a less than honorable discharge, and he's been told by the VA that he won't get any medical benefits. So he served in Iraq two times. He was cited for his valor and bravery. Mm-hmm. He showed me his certificates. He helped save Marines' lives. He was talked about being officer material, but he comes back. He starts falling apart emotionally, and he now is a complete. He's a mess too. He's gotten a job at a life insurance company, but his housemate, he shares a house with an old friend. His housemate described to me the flashbacks he has, where in the middle of the night he'll go into a rage. He literally has smashed their stereo equipment. He's smashed their computers. And anybody tries to get close to him, he gets violent because he thinks he's back in Iraq. And this is a young man who, on the surface, you know, looks good. He's charming. He's smart. He sells you life insurance. And then he goes home, and he's a disaster for his family.
And there's the national dilemma right out of this war.
And he's getting no benefits.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us, Daniel Zwerdl. Let me turn to Gerald in Davenport, Iowa. Hi, Gerald. You're on the air.
Yes.
What's your experience, Gerald?
Well, I just wanted to make the point that we need to understand, first of all, that yes, there are problems with the system. Just as the gentleman said, you know, the military, the army didn't plan, the administration didn't plan for this getting this ugly. Mm-hmm. I was injured in 2003, shot down my helicopter. I'm partially paralyzed, got no bowel and bladder function. It's pretty much a mess.
From Iraq, Gerald.
Yes, I was in Iraq. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it was pretty early on before the big wave of attacks started hitting. It's just like I said, in the fall of 2003.
Yep.
But still, you know, my care was, and once again, like I said, there have been issues, and there were issues even with me. But I think from the funding that the VA had and Walter Reed and all those places, I think I got pretty darn good care. I think I was, you know, I was looked after pretty decently. Like I said, it wasn't perfect.
Right.
But there's a lot of issues that went into play. And I just want to make the point that I think, you know, it's hard fought, but the system is trying.
Gerald, stand by for just a moment, if you would. Danny Zwerdling, here's Gerald. He, can't, you know, wounded in Iraq, comes back. He's got hassles to deal with, big ones, but yet you hear the generosity in his view of how the military is doing. What do you say to it?
Well, first of all, Gerald, thank you so much for calling and hanging in there. Gerald raises a very important point, and that is that, and Tom, you started to raise it earlier, and then I think I digressed. Yes, there are, first of all, wonderful people who work in the medical system, both inside the military and inside the veterans system. You know, wonderful doctors, wonderful mental health people. And there are, you know, they want to give good care, and there are many people out there, I have no doubt, who have gotten excellent care. The problem is the system has been overwhelmed, so there aren't enough people to go around for everybody, and there are many, many people who have not gotten good care. So, yes, we don't mean to say that the system is a total disaster and there's nobody good in it, far from the truth. But there are thousands and thousands of thousands. We don't know how many thousands who have been who have had miserable experiences are desperate and are not getting the help they need. And a good question is, well, how many are there? And we don't know. We started talking about the problem with the statistics earlier, and there's a lot more to say. Maybe we won't have time for it. But Gerald, thank you for calling.
Gerald, do you feel the country has been as generous with you as you're being in your attitude, you know, toward the military, saying it's doing the best it can?
Are you talking about civilians in general, just the regular population?
Well, I guess the government and its treatment of you. Have you felt fully well cared for?
Well, let's also make another distinction here. I was in the National Guard, activated, of course, went to Iraq. When I came back to the Midwest. Okay, I came back to where there was only like three. I got sent back to my hometown, thank God, and that's one issue. I had to go through a lot of problems to get back to my hometown. They didn't want to send me there. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I got sent to the Midwest VA Center. I was only one of three Iraqi war veterans at the Milwaukee VA. And so I was, you know, not to say, I was the very few, so they treated me with a lot of care because I was, you know.
You were special at that point. You were rare.
Yeah, pretty much what I said. I didn't want to say it myself, but.
Yeah. You were, and we hear that you still are. And, Gerald, we appreciate your call. We're glad you got that care, and we thank you for your call today. Thanks very much for coming in. We're talking this hour about Iraq and Afghanistan, war veterans, and the hard side of coming home. With NPR correspondent Daniel Zwerdling, who spent much of the last year investigating soldiers' struggles and the U.S. military's struggle to accept and deal with them. Here's a bit from his interview with the chief psychiatrist at Fort Carson's Mental Health Center. Dr. Stephen Knorr said officers should get rid of troubled soldiers.
You know, from a commander's standpoint and from a staff sergeant's standpoint, a staff sergeant might have 30 soldiers in his platoon, and he has to get them trained and ready and working as a cohesive team. If he has one or two soldiers who are not showing up for work, who are showing up intoxicated, who are using illicit drugs or going AWOL, that soldier with the misconduct problems is dragging down the whole platoon. And they don't have time for that.
Tape from NPR's Daniel Zwerdling there at Fort Carson, Colorado. Laura is calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Tom. My son served in Iraq in 2004 from April through December, returned home with full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder. It was apparent he came home, started acting out. It was mildly addressed in his unit, but he often had to go out for counseling and so on and so forth. And he was harassed and ostracized by his commanding officer, forced to resign his position as first lieutenant, which he did. In fact, returned home to Beaufort in 2005 and committed suicide. And I feel, as a parent, he was not given the appropriate care while he was in the Army. This young man wanted to serve his country. He loved his country. And he was mistreated when he returned home. And as a parent, I'm now a member of Gold Star Families Speak Out and Military Families Organization, speaking out for better veterans care for these returning troops. And it's so appropriate that you do address this on veterans, and I really appreciate it.
Laura, we're so sorry for your family's loss and for the loss of your son. You must have given this a lot of thought. You know what the military is tasked to do. And yes, you know well the problems your son was struggling with. How do you think that the military should handle that kind of situation?
Well, I think there should be more treating these returning troops, not just filing through the system, taking the time and saying, "Hey, this guy was in Iraq. He did his duty. He was in charge of many a troop when he was over there, and you know he did a great job. Why not spend the time and, you know, let him go to his counseling or whatever and not mistreat him within the unit itself." It was like he was a disgrace. And I don't, being out of Fort Hood, Texas, he was literally lost in the shuffle of the system, you know.
And, Laura, Daniel, speak to Laura, if you would.
Laura, I feel heartsick hearing this, and I have heard this from so many families, and I admire you for calling us and telling us about it. And I want to do a quick little bit of math while Laura's on the phone. If you, given that about 1.5 million people have already served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and given that, and here's a statistic I wanted to mention earlier, the Army's own studies show that 25 to 30% of all the soldiers they have surveyed have symptoms of serious mental health problems. Now, this is not people who have actively necessarily sought treatment, but according to their confidential surveys, 25 to 30% of all the soldiers who've served in Iraq have symptoms of serious mental health problems. So that's about, if you extrapolate that through with 1.5 million troops who've served, let's say 500,000 perhaps then have symptoms of serious mental health problems, or a little less than that, 400,000. They come home and look at the ripple effects, the tragic ripple effects. Here's a grieving mother. There are other family members, friends whose entire lives are turned upside down. So we're not talking just about 400 or 500,000 troops. We're talking about millions of Americans who are suffering in very, very grave ways because of these mental health problems that aren't getting enough attention.
Laura, what's the lesson you've taken from your experience?
I just wanted to mention that if it wasn't for Military Families Organization, Military Families Speak Out, they were the support for me. I had, the military cuts you loose, when the person is discharged or, resigns the commission. These groups have been wonderful. They have been, I've had the support that I've needed to get through this very difficult time. It hasn't even been 2 years yet, and, I'm still reeling from all those events, but it's given me strength to speak out like I'm doing today.
Laura, please tell us your son's name so that we can remember him.
His name was First Lieutenant Philip Kent.
First Lieutenant Philip hint.
And Laura, if you don't mind, I would really appreciate it if you could call me at National Public Radio later, because I'd like to talk with you more about this terrible event.
Laura, thank you very much for calling.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Partly as largely as a response to Daniel Zwirtling's reporting, some changes have been made, but not necessarily fully embraced. Earlier this year, Fort Carson, Colorado, launched a new training program to teach officers how to help soldiers with PTSD. Here's Laurel Anderson, a psychiatric nurse, leading a session talking about the new policies. But you can hear as the lecture progresses, her attitude emerges.
Well, the fact is, most soldiers who have PTSD do not go AWOL. They do not beat up their family. They do not take drugs. They just don't do that. Not most soldiers. And the Army's always going to be a disciplined organization and with no room for that kind of conduct. The truth is, the Army has one mission: kill the enemy. Its mission's not long-term care.
Daniel Zwirtling, the mission is to kill the enemy, not long-term care.
Well, how do we start with that? First of all, the general at Fort Carson at the time told me that because of the stories on NPR, they realized that they needed to do a better job. He said an even better job taking care of troops coming back with mental health problems. And so they started this new training program. The top officials at the Pentagon then said that we're planning to use Fort Carson's new training program as a template, as a model for a training program throughout all the Army. So I sent this entire training session that you just heard an excerpt from to a handful of mental health specialists who work with the military, and they were stunned. They said that at best, this session was a complete waste of time for the military leaders who attended it, everybody from sergeants up to the general. And they said at worst, they thought it would actually reinforce the terrible attitudes that many people in the military already had about soldiers with mental health problems, as you could hear in this, seem to hear between the lines in this woman's voice. Now, the Pentagon consulted with one of the mental health specialists who I talked with, who was very critical. And they've put out now a new PTSD training program for the whole Army. And I've seen some of that material, and it does seem to be much better than the one that at Fort Carson, thank goodness. But I have not yet attended any of the training sessions, so I can't vouch for it one way or the other.
But what about the country's attitude toward its own military and its operations? I mean, the psychiatric nurse here is pointing out essentially what we do ask of the military. We ask them to fight wars. She says our mission is not long-term care. And, the way in which they're funded and structured, perhaps that's true.
I kept asking military officials about this, and several have given me a very articulate reason why. Even if you let's be completely heartless for a moment, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's not care about what our hearts tell us and what our souls tell us about the ethical and moral obligations to young people you ask to serve in a war, okay? Let's put all of that aside and just be completely crass and self-interested. These military specialists have said to me, if you want to have a volunteer military, if you want, committed young men and women to sign up for it, if you want them to re-enlist after they've already served, if you want their friends and family to support their service, then you've got to convince everybody that if you get in trouble, that the military will truly leave no fallen comrade behind. That's the slogan, right? Well, it's not supposed to just mean when you had your leg blown off. It's supposed to mean when you have serious mental health problems. And these military specialists have said to me, we cannot have an effective military volunteer force if people don't think that they're going to get cared for when they're in desperate trouble.
Let's go to Barbara in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm glad you're taking my call. I'm an old vet. I got out of service in 66. Back then, women were not allowed to do a lot of things, like photograph Bay of Pigs, which was the activity that I was involved in. My concern is that we have money for this so-called war, this administration is putting it in, but there's no money for mental health, there's no money for regular health, with the exception of few healthy people. I'd like to know what the administration can do to put more money into mental health and to help at least two of my friends who are living at the Causeway unit in Boston. They have no money for health. They have no money for living on their own, and they're not stable enough to do that. But they are out of the military simply because they had PTSD full-blown and could not be taken care of at the VA in Jamaica Plain.
Barbara, thanks for that. Daniel Zordling, I mean, here comes the question of whether the country is willing to step up and take on the full cost of war, or whether we sort of, you know, we lay it off on the people who bear the brunt, and then sooner or later they're on their own.
Well, this is a good time to mention that there has been a flurry of activity in Congress, in the White House, and in the Defense Department. Top officials saying, we realize we haven't done enough to treat the troops with mental health problems, and we're going to fix it. The Pentagon had a mental health task force, which did a big study. Congress ordered that study, and the task force a few months ago basically acknowledged what I and other reporters have been saying for a long time, and that's that the mental health care in at most military installations they visited was bad. There weren't enough mental health people, and there were huge problems. And then the Dole Shalala Commission, remember? President Bush appointed them after the Washington Post did a terrific series early this year on Walter Reed. And the Dole Shalala Commission agreed that the system of taking care of troops with mental health and physical injuries was a mess, and they made all kinds of recommendations. Well, now, the White House has sent a bill to Congress, and Congress members of Congress have their own bills, which say they will solve these problems, and they will adopt many of the fixes that the Dole Shalala Commission recommended and that the Mental Health Task Force from the Pentagon recommended. The problem is that it's one thing to fix something on paper, and it's another thing to fix it in fact. The military, for the last few years, has done all kinds of supposed fixes on paper. And that training program at Fort Carson is one tiny example. You know, they say there's a phrase in the military, we've checked off the box. Did we budget more money to hire mental health specialists next year? Yes. Okay, we've checked that off the box. Have we started a new training program? Yes, we've checked that off the box. You know, you go down the list. The problem is that when you start looking in detail, as I've done a little bit at some of these programs, when you start looking in detail at what's actually going on the ground at the military bases, it's often Mickey Mouse. It's amateurish. The programs, like the one I saw, was lousy. The mental health specialists who they are hiring, you know, they don't have enough. They can't find trained mental health specialists who have training in these kinds of mental health problems. I mean, we could talk all day about these. So yes, the efforts are being made to make their system better. But so far, those efforts seem, you know, way too little too late. Are they going to help? Well, I sure hope so. Is it good that they're making changes now? Yes, it's very important. But, you know, it doesn't look enough yet to really solve the problem. And one of the problems it doesn't solve is all the people who've already come back from the war, who already had crises, who already got kicked out of the military without all their benefits. You know, what about all those folks?
Let me get one more call from Ray in Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
How you doing, Tom?
All right.
All right. Just wanted to call. I just got a service. I'm a veteran here. I served two tours in Iraq.
Thank you.
I got an honorable discharge medically out of the service and May 23rd.
Medically, but honorable. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yes, sir. Just here.
And what's your medical issue, Ray?
Well, I have a severe case of PTSD, and I've been shot twice. And I got out for that. Now, I'm here in Columbia, South Carolina, and I went down to the VA department here in Columbia, South Carolina when I first got out. I had a little bit of trouble with them because, you know, I had to prove to them that, you know, I hadn't been shot twice. I'd been a sole survivor twice. I lost all my men twice. And I was an infantry ranger, and I had to prove to them all this information, which was really hard for me to go through. Bear with me here. I'm trying to push through this myself. And it was hard, but for their sake, I'm going to say that they did do a good job. Once I was able to prove to them what was going on, probably within about a month later, they had already had me in a program here at the VA. I go once a month. They see me, talk to me. They got me in PTSD programs, which is actually helping a lot. Now, he was saying earlier about the not being so experienced, some of the personnel. Now, I will admit that they have some issues with the medical part as far as trying to help PTSD guys out, because the medical part here is they really hurting. They're still trying to figure out what drugs help the PTSD personnel, stuff like that, because I've been through probably 8 or 9 different type of medications that they still experimenting, so to speak.
Ray, we're running right up against the end of our show here, but I'm awfully grateful to you for calling in with that report, and thank you again for your service, and we wish you good luck. Daniel Zwirling, I'm struck again by the generosity of these soldiers who have served. You know, they're saying, you know, there's Ray. And you hear his story, and he's saying, it wasn't easy, but I'm getting something here. It's not perfect, but he sounds grateful.
I've been stunned that almost all of the troops I've talked with now, dozens and dozens of troops, no matter how bad, no matter what their problems have been, no matter how badly they've been treated or discharged, they almost all are very generous, and they all say, I don't regret signing up, and I would go back in a second. They all say that. They say they want to serve their country. They do expect something in return.
Let's hope the country can be as generous as those troops, exactly like Ray. And Ray, thanks again. Daniel Zwirling, we're so admiring and grateful for your reporting in this last year and for the time you're spending with us on this Veterans Day weekend. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for looking into this issue.
NPR's Daniel Zwirling. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.